This is Radio Freethinker, episode 86.
And welcome to Radio Freethinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, broadcast out of CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver on the wet and rainy UBC campus. And we're also now on the air in Kamloops.
Woohoo! Go Kamloops!
On the X, CFBX 92.5 FM. So welcome. Yeah. Welcome, Kamloops listeners. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of the Center for Inquiry here in Vancouver.
And this is Don, on-air talent, star of the show, political science and philosopher.
This is Chloe, and I'm desperately in search of a longer title if anyone wants to phone in and suggest one.
And I'm Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers Club and economics student here at UBC.
So I'd like to apologize, kind of, for the first song, The Cars Drive, goes with the theme of our show, which you'll find out later, but the song itself has absolutely nothing to do with the theme of it. It's just cars and driving. Get that in your head and you go, wow, I wonder what connection there might be between those two things.
There are so many better songs to have chosen from, and we had to pick this one.
Well, it was all up to Daniel. Daniel chose the song.
I screwed it up. It's all my bad.
So how was your week, Ethan?
Actually, you know, I had a pretty good week. It was a very interesting set of days before and immediately after the weekend.
I hate to inform you this, but there quite often are days before and after weekends.
Yeah, well, this time there was. You see, we found out that we have been syndicated, as I mentioned, every Wednesday at 1 p.m. on, as I said, the X, CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops. And we are very grateful to CFBX for airing us and allowing our message of skepticism to reach the good people of Kamloops. It's very exciting for us. You know, it's also nice that we have a local skeptical organization in Kamloops who helped us get this spot, the Kamloops Rationalists, and we thank them for helping us out. To all our new listeners in Kamloops, you can learn more about our show on our website, www.radiofreethinker.com, and listen to our back episodes on iTunes.
And if you have any suggestions for what we're doing, you can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
And if you really dig us, just dig us. At dig.com.
Okay, sure.
Kids are hip. They know what's going on.
I'm sure they are. And, you know, if there's any local skeptical news in Kamloops, feel free to pass it along our way. Later in the show, we're going to have an interview with the director of the Kamloops Rationals, Bill Leiterwood, so stay tuned for that. But another cool news that's been going on lately, on Friday, CFI, the UBC Biology Department, and the UBC Freethinkers set up an evolution information booth here at UBC when a creationist showed up to give a lecture called Evolution, the Greatest Hoax on Earth.
Now, I'm sure Ethan's going to go into a bit more detail about the event itself. I went to this event myself just out of the off chance that maybe something would happen. And something did happen. There was a few tempers, etc. But it goes back. I don't know why we show up for these events, but Ethan, tell us why you showed up for that event. What information can you tell us about it?
Well, let me tell you about the creationist in question here. This one, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, a chemist who has no background in biology, I should mention,
and Australian.
No, I think he's New Zealand.
Really?
Kiwi, yeah. I think he was. Whatever. This guy was a clown. And I realize that's an ad hominem, but the pure ignorance of this guy was absolutely startling. You know, at least for someone like Hugh Ross, who we debated previously, who was at least logically consistent within his own mental universe, this guy was all over the map.
I loved his one example about why fish can't fossilize. And he says, and I quote, "Fish, when they die, what do? Take a look at your goldfish. What does it do? It floats on the top. Therefore, fish can never fossilize because they're always going to float and get eaten." Yeah. And the only explanation is the flood.
It was
really?
Bad.
Was that really what he said?
That's really what he said. And that was the only evidence he gets. He says, "See, look, they float down to the bottom and they get covered. That's what you learned in your textbook. But just go to your fish tank. Fish all float." I'm going, no, some float for a while, but then they sink. They all sink.
That's brilliant.
He basically accused any biology professor, and there were actually several there, of indoctrinating students into atheism and suggested that atheists have no moral character. So, I mean, right off the bat, not only is this guy ignorant of facts, but he's also crazy, I think. Now, he didn't just speak at UBC. I mean, he got a pretty harsh welcome here at UBC. He also spoke in Surrey and in Kelowna. We were lucky that in UBC we were able to get a booth. I mean, I guess the university still has some semblance of academic honesty and integrity. So we had an educational evolution booth where we had some books. We had some biology professors on hand to answer some questions. When he spoke in Surrey, the organizers basically told us, no way, you can't set up an evolution booth. They said that if we were doing a talk, we wouldn't let creationists in, which is actually wrong because we have and we do, but they didn't care. When they went to Kelowna, members of CFI Okanagan showed up to ask questions, of which Dr. Safadi either ignored or refused to answer. And he also apparently made some racist jokes about Jewish people and Muslims, which is just like, what? Why would you do that? What cause do you have to do that?
Well, I can give you the real cause. I mean, one of the things I noticed when people asked him questions was, one, he didn't really answer the questions. He did it fluffily, and then he just tried to bugger off, get out of here, to stop talking, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't actually there to inform or debate. He just wanted to do his thing, and if you were in his way, he got angry. I mean, he, from what I understand, even he was shouting towards the end of his talk here. And
oh, yeah.
I don't know, because I got so upset, I walked out myself after a little bit of an outburst. Justifiable. He wasn't answering the question.
Yeah, he was kind of a real jerk. I mean, like, again, when you compare him to other creationists who will at least try to answer questions and sound intelligent, this guy was more like a screaming child. But anyway, it was kind of fun in that sense, just to see him, you know, absolutely act like a moron.
I don't like bear baiting. I can understand that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah.
And the evolution table was a great success. I'm quite happy we did that. And, you know, we got a lot of interesting people come up and talk to us afterwards for about an hour or so. So it was quite successful.
There was a lot of people who came up to us thinking we were like the Sephardi organizer people, too.
Yeah.
Pretty funny.
Yeah.
What were the reactions of the people that came up to you like? Were they nasty? Were they supportive?
When I was there, and I had to leave fairly early for work, but when I was there, the people who came up were generally interested. It was, they wanted to know more. They wanted to hear from both sides. Hmm. And so, I don't know, it was generally positive. There were some people who clearly just didn't want to look at our stuff, but for the most part, it wasn't too bad.
There were a lot of curious people there who just wanted to ask questions. And it was great that we had experts on hand, because they're questions that I can't really answer all that well.
Actually, I thought there was sort of two good things or good bad things. When I walked out, I didn't actually notice the table, because apparently they had forced them to move the table relatively far away from the front door of where the talk was, because they were worried about competition. I mean, the greatest fear to these people is actually knowledge. But when I walked outside, I heard someone say, you know, that's right, the eye is irreducible. It just doesn't work. And I had like about a 5-minute discussion about how you can explain that it's not really irreducible, and there's this whole track. But one of the things I also thought was quite interesting is I noticed who walked out before I did were people who I'm assuming were quite religious, because they had some really thick Bibles. It was almost like he was annoying people on both sides of the
Well, he was an obnoxious person.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's probably one of the big reasons people were walking out. He was just obnoxious. But on better news, we had our fourth skeptic camp here in Vancouver on Saturday. It was also the second one this year. It was a great success. We had lots of people who attended. The talks were really great. Last time, Radio Free Thinker provided a talk. This time, I gave a talk on supporting skeptical organizations, and Don gave a great talk on political skepticism. Daniel didn't do a talk, but he was in the audience, and Chloe didn't show up.
I know, I'm a bad person, I'm sorry.
Very bad person.
I'm terrible.
But otherwise, I had a great time at Skeptic Camp.
I thought it was actually quite a good time, too. I'm not big on the morning part, but the afternoon and the later part was quite good, actually. There's a lot of dynamic talks and a lot of feedback. The format, I'm not sure if I like the format as much. I know one of the things that they tried to do was they tried to have a different type of format. Shorter talks, you know, 50-50 sort of questions. And that was good. If anyone else who was at the Skeptic Camp said, hey, you know, it could be improved this way or that way, you can also contact us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. And I don't know, it was good. It was different. I'd like some more time to talk about some of the issues, but...
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a bit of a change in pace from the previous Skeptic Camp, where we had like 20-minute talks in some cases. So, I mean, it's one of those things you're probably not going to please everybody, but I thought it was relatively successful.
And as good skeptics and people who believe in the scientific method, we were experimenting. It was a different experiment to see how it went.
Yeah.
I wanted to go back just one step, because I'm curious to know your, Ethan and the other guys, with regards to those creationists.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. So it was good that we went out and we provided information, but should we have shunned the talk itself? So the table was good. I think the table was an excellent idea. But should we have just given the actual talk itself? I mean, because, you know, I don't think any of us gained anything from it. We annoyed him, which maybe was good, but I'm not that petty. So do you think it was good to have been in his face and there and confronting him, or should we have sat back and been more passive in our response? Chloe, what do you think, since you weren't there? What do you think?
What do I think, seeing as I wasn't there?
Do you think we should be right in their face, or should we have been more passive?
I don't think we should have been more passive, certainly. I think the idea of is just having a booth and having information available and just having visibility was probably enough. I'm not a very confrontational person, period. So I rarely support confrontation of any kind, I'm not going to lie, unless it's, like, abuse. Of course, you could argue that creationism is an abuse of knowledge, so... That's my diplomatic answer.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I'm around the same way. I'm not a huge confrontational person when it comes to something like creationism. But, I mean, I don't really care if others want to do that. So I think the mixture of having a booth that was there just for information, it was very passive. People came up to us for information. We didn't actively shove information in people's faces, as well as the more direct questioning. I think they both are valid methods.
Two things. One, I think this really goes back to we discussed a few episodes ago about the panel that you saw at, I forgot, the conference.
The Secular Humanism Conference?
Yeah, where there was a panel about confrontation versus accommodation. And I think accommodation is a poor choice, but I don't think confrontation is really a good one either. It's hard to strike a balance. But I think the second thing I would say is that we need both. I mean... People love the skeptical movement because it's not dogmatic, but if we're going to have any visibility, we need some kind of confrontational front.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can respect the point of view that we don't want to shine a light on this guy by having him, like, debate Dawkins or something. But I think that we get a lot out of going to these events. I think that the majority of the people that I talked to did not have a background in science, but... they were unsure of what they had been told. And I think that if we had just left them to their own devices going to this talk, they would have gotten completely the wrong information. So I think the information table was very, very important. I think that going in there, asking him probing questions, and giving this guy a taste of the scientific method is also very important, because it lets people know that the people who are on the fence, that this guy is not telling you the truth. He's, in some cases, lying to you. It also showcases that science is not a passive field. It's not just some guy comes up there, talks for 20 minutes, people take notes, and they leave. Science is a bit of a confrontational system. It is designed to test ideas and to make people defend what they're saying. And this guy could not defend what he was saying, because obviously what he was saying is completely and utterly bupkis. But I favor a strong approach to this. I think that you have to choose your battles, and I think this is a battle that you absolutely have to choose. You cannot have a university maintain any credibility when you have someone like this come in and not just promote a wrong idea. There's nothing wrong, per se, about being wrong. But this guy was ignorant of human realities. This guy thinks that higher education promotes an immoral lifestyle. That's insulting to every student who comes here and every professor who teaches here. It's like when someone accuses somebody of saying, well, you believe in evolution. Hitler liked evolution. Ergo, you are a Nazi. That cannot be let go.
Actually, you know, and I think actually this was one of the better, as annoying as it was, and as much as I wondered why I was there, better examples of how skepticism can play both sides of the table. Because we had an information table outside. That was sort of your passive accommodationalist type thing, right? Provide information, but not in your face. And then we had a few people inside who were asking probing questions. It was important, and I don't think I did or anyone else called him a poo-poo head or anything. They were commenting on his arguments and his misuse of information. Mm-hmm. So it was very pointed. So it wasn't like being an asshole in the sense of I'm attacking you, but your argument. And I think that in that sense, it was actually a very interesting mix. And I think what Ethan was trying to set there is as skeptics and as people who believe in science, we're all for a diversity of views. And some views are more defendable than others. It's only when you do overtly wrong views, or you meaningfully distort the truth or the evidence or people, that it becomes untenable, like Holocaust deniers, right? I mean, I think creationism is that sort of level of thing, right? I mean, that doesn't mean that they're racist, but to deny that is one step along that way. And as you say, if this guy's talking racist jokes and how anyone who believes in Darwin is morally suspect and Christians never lie, like he was doing during his whole talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, anyone who was there and heard the questions that we asked and heard his responses knows who the asshole was at that talk. Why don't we go to a commercial break, and we'll come back with our interview with Bill Leiterwood of the Camelist Rationalists.
I swear to God, I'm not wearing just my underwear right now. This is Beth.
Hi, this is Beth Ditto from The Gossip, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. No, yeah, this is the best thing in the world. You guys are going to be blown away.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Techs, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Bill Leiterwood, who is the director of the Kamloops Center for Rational Thought, based out of Kamloops, British Columbia. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ethan. Nice to be here.
So now that Radio Freethinker is being aired in Kamloops on CFBX 92.5 FM, we thought we should get the perspective of skeptics in Kamloops. So tell us a bit about the Kamloops Rationalists. When and why did they form?
Okay. Well, first of all, welcome to Kamloops. It's so great that this show is now going to be able to be heard here. And it's quite an accomplishment for both yourselves and ourselves to get that to happen. The Kamloops Center for Rational Thought started about, in the fall of 2009, after I attended a convention in California and just got really inspired and came back and said, okay, if they can have a group in Saskatoon and Okotoks and everywhere else under the sun, we should be able to get one together here. So I basically embarked on an epic voyage to try and get a group going here, and we succeeded in doing that.
And what's been the reaction from the community of Kamloops?
Actually, it's been pretty interesting, Ethan. We managed to get a column in the newspaper on a regular basis, and a lot of the reaction online with the column in the online part of the newspaper has been, I'd say, about 50-50, probably 50% of people that think I'm crazy and 50% that think it's a great breath of fresh air. The editor, on the other hand, after running two columns, said that the reaction was about 80-20 in favor. So it's been astonishingly good, as far as I'm concerned. I really thought there would be a lot more sort of negative blowback from the religious community, but there hasn't really been any.
And you mentioned a column in the newspaper. Which newspaper is that?
It's Canis This Week. It's published twice weekly. We had a column in both. There's also a daily paper, and we did get one in that paper. But that paper wasn't crazy about giving us a regular one. So they just said, you know, whenever we feel like it, we'll give you one. So the twice weekly free paper that everyone gets said they would run it on a regular basis, but they wanted it to be exclusive. So we're just in the one paper at this point.
Okay. And so what sort of things does your group write about in the paper?
Well, I think we write about probably the same kind of stuff that you talk about on the radio show. I mean, at first, the first column, for example, what I did was I used some of the existing information that CFI has provided us because we are a CFI affiliate, and I just made up a column on basically what the term atheist means, what it is to be an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first one. And then in the second one, because most of the reaction to that one was, yeah, okay, but why do you care? Why do you care whether the local taxpayer-funded Christian school here teaches creation? And, you know, why do you care? So the second column, I basically talked about why we care, about the fact that, you know, what the Christian school here is doing is teaching non-scientific, complete religious bunk to kids and telling them it's science. We have a problem with that, as I think probably you would and anyone else would. So, and I talked about why we care generally about the planet, why we care about global warming, why we care about the environment. We care about it because we don't believe that we're suddenly going to be raptured up into heaven when Armageddon happens. So we're not really crazy about seeing Armageddon happen, and we're not really crazy about seeing the end times because, first of all, we don't believe there is such a thing, but you know, we want to try and make life as bearable and as pleasant as we can for everybody on this planet. And specifically in Kamloops, we're just trying to knock down some of the religious barriers that are there. I mean, I thought it was a far more religious place than it is, and I don't know whether it's a strategy they're employing to just be quiet or whether they're really just kind of taken aback. I don't know.
So could you give us, like, perspective for people who haven't been to Kamloops? Is it a very religious place, or are there a lot of skeptical battlegrounds going on there?
There's not a lot of battles going on. I mean, at the moment, there probably is as a result of our group and our profile. But no, before you could have fooled me that there was any other people out there. And as you've probably found as well, maybe less so in Vancouver, but in small places like this, when you're a free thinker or a skeptic or an atheist or an agnostic or whatever you want to call us, you know, you kind of feel pretty alone.
Uh-huh.
You know, you kind of feel like, geez, there's nobody else out there, and even if there is, how am I going to find them? So that's really what we as a group have been trying to focus on is just getting together with other people of like mind and letting them know that, yeah, there are lots of us out there. Kamloops is, generally speaking, it's a cowboy town.
Uh-huh.
So you would think it would be pretty religious. I mean, there's lots of churches, but it's, I don't know, they don't seem to have an extremely high profile in the community. And most people in our circle of friends, for example, just personally that we know, certainly don't go to church. They may be believers or they may even be religious, but they certainly don't go to church. The churches around here are closing up almost as fast as the schools.
Wow. So So you guys mentioned community activism, providing a resource to non-believers. What kind of events do you guys like to do? Do you do talks and lectures or skeptics in the pub type things?
We did a pub night, and that was quite successful. What we've been doing on a regular basis is we've been running movies. We've been doing a movie night once a month, where we've been running things like Jesus Camp, we ran last time. And the time before that, we ran a film called Deliver Us From Evil. Next month, we're running Julia Sweeney's one-woman show, Letting Go of God. So we're doing that, and those have been, we've been getting more and more people out to that. We just had a very successful event where we were invited to take part in an ongoing thing that the Council of Canadians puts on called Philosopher's Cafe. Mm-hmm. This is held in a local deli downtown, sort of a coffee house. And we actually just hosted that on Tuesday night, and it was an overwhelming success. The place was just packed. We had around 70 people, and it turned out really, really well. And we got a lot of interest from other free thinkers in town that did show up to that and have since joined the group. And there were some religious people there as well. So it was actually a really interesting discussion. And there was a moderator who wasn't me, so he kind of kept things under control. But I think we're going to try and do more of that kind of thing, because we discussed it. We had an executive meeting after that, and we sort of thought, you know, this is something we have to spend a lot more time doing, and that's giving opportunities for all of us to get together and just have, you know, quote, fellowship, unquote. Uh-huh. So the couple of members that we have up at the university here are going to organize a Skeptics in the Pub. At the university pub up there at Heroes. And we're going to try and organize some more regular, like, potlucks or even just, I don't know, just get-togethers, so that we can all just get together and hang out, because that seems to be something that's lacking, and it seems to be something that everyone really wants to do. Just everyone is so thankful so far that we've talked to. They're so thankful when they find out that there's someone else that thinks the same way they do. And they just really want to hang out, you know, have a few beers, have a glass of wine, and just yak.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So if somebody is listening to this interview and they're in Kamloops, how do they get in touch with you guys?
Okay, well, we have a website, which is kamloopsatheist.com. And we have also an email address, which is kamloopsatheist@shaw.ca. And I should mention, too, that we've just started on a billboard campaign up at the university. I should have sent you a picture of this, because you'll probably get a kick out of it if you didn't see it yet. But we're advertising in those billboards that they have in washrooms.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen those?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, so we've got 10 of those at the university. And they're the ones that are, there's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life. And then it's got our name and our website. And it also has, we actually took it from the New Zealand group that did billboards. And they put, one of them is, in the beginning, man created God. And then it says, there's probably no God, so stop worrying and enjoy your life. And the other one is, we're all atheists about most gods. We just go one God further.
Excellent.
Yeah, so we haven't had a lot of reaction to those, but they are up at the university, and you know, we're hoping to get some more reaction from the university. I've been kind of disappointed that we haven't been able to do that. So we're trying to do that. We're trying to bring in speakers. We're looking at possibly organizing a one-day seminar/conference for the spring. And bringing a few, high-profile speakers in for something like that. So that's what we're up to, and that's how they can get a hold of us.
Excellent. Well, Bill, thanks for joining us, and thanks for all your help in getting Radio Free Thinker on the air in Kamloops.
And thank you for doing Radio Free Thinker, Ethan, and thanks for all your help and everyone else at CFI. It's invaluable to all of us out here in the hinterland.
Excellent. Well, Bill, talk to you soon, and best of luck.
Okay, thanks, man.
Yeah, yeah, it's sick, that. Yeah, that's good. Wait, hold on a minute. Pull it up. Stop. You know what you want to do with that, right?
Put it on CITR 101.9 FM.
You want to put a banging donk on it.
Yeah, 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 that's sick. That is sick. I can definitely drop to that one. All we need now is, like, a hook line. You know what? I've got actually the
perfect one. Baseline. Oh, wicked. Don't put a donk on it.
Yeah, the state of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. But I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So thanks, Bill, for that interview. Now, as we said, we started out the show with a song.
The Cars and Drive. Now, who out there can make the connection between The Cars and Drive? Anyone? Anyone?
I can.
What is it?
Pick me.
Chloe, for
$200. $200? Is it about transportation?
It is. It's about transportation. But I'm not going to talk about transportation. Are you talking about transportation, Ethan?
No, I never talk about transportation.
I'm not talking about transportation. Who's left?
I guess it has to be me.
It's you.
Damn, I should have prepared something. No. After that opening. Yeah, the main topic for our show this week is transportation policy. Along with some of the talks at Skepticamp, politics and skepticism, and the party Reason Vancouver, which is starting. It is Reason Vancouver, right?
Yeah.
I thought it'd be interesting to talk about politics of the Vancouver area, although it applies to pretty much any urban area. So I'm just going to say a few things before I get too much into this. Because I couldn't find evidence for a lot of this, a lot of what I will be saying will be relying on microeconomic reasoning.
For the sake of this discussion, I'm going to take off my socialist hat and allow you to pretend that economics really exists, and I won't criticize at every point. So continue, Daniel. I won't try.
I'm not entirely assuming everyone is perfectly rational, if that helps.
That is a wise assumption to make.
And I also won't be taking environmental concerns or health concerns into consideration. Not because they aren't important, and not because politicians shouldn't take those into consideration, but just because we'll be here for like 8 hours if I'm bringing everything you possibly could into transportation.
So if you're not bringing in the environment or health concerns, what is the focus of your transportation policy exposition here, a little thought experiment?
Basically, it's what are effective policies the government can take to get people efficiently from one place to another. We'll get them efficiently from places they need to go to a lot. And so there's sort of a short and a longer term look in this. So there'll be a little difference between the two. So I'll start with the most common way politicians, most common cure they have for transportation woes. And that's making bigger highways, making bigger bridges, making bigger tunnels, making bigger everything. Now, I looked around for justifications for this by politicians or by academics or anyone, and basically all it comes down to is if old roads can't support the number of cars, it's obvious that bigger roads can support the number of cars.
This actually, I think, largely came historically in the United States when they were trying to expand the United States. Having more room than they really needed, because there was a lot of space, the idea was, well, if we just made bigger roads, then it's just an intuitive thing, right? So out of the 40s and 50s, there came this huge building boom of highways and roads connecting everyone to mm-hmm. everything, and that's largely where you get this ethos of bigger is better.
Yeah, and I mean, even back in the 30s and 40s, there was people, some of the major architects of all these highways, Robert Moses being one of the biggest ones. He designed pretty much all the highways in New York. He suspected that maybe this isn't the best plan. And it took quite a few years before there was serious research and thought into it. But I think he was justified in saying that.
Designed highways? I mean, it's just a piece of flat with... Okay, I'm sure there's a lot of
civil engineers here who probably hate you now. There's a reason they cost billions and billions of dollars. Into sort of the reasoning against expanding highways as a means to improving transportation. I'll get into the evidence after, but now here's just the reasoning. Most decisions that people make about where they're going to live, how they're going to commute, and where new houses will be put up, where businesses will relocate, depend to some extent on the current transportation system and expectations about what it's going to be like in the future. So, as an example, in my hometown Langley, which is about a 50-minute drive from downtown Vancouver with a little or no traffic, or about 1.5 hours to 2 hours during rush hour.
And about a little over two hours by transit. I used to live in UBC and actually work in Surrey, so I can tell you it's about 2.5 hours just to mass transit.
Last summer I transited to UBC from Langley, and it's about a two-hour round trip to UBC, not downtown Vancouver. A lot of people who live there, or a lot of the new houses that are constantly being built there, probably wouldn't be if there wasn't the expectation now that the Gateway Project is going on. For those who don't know, or those who don't live in Vancouver and have no reason to know, the Gateway Project is, I think it's something like a $18 billion, like, decade-long plan for expanding a whole bunch of different highways and transit routes in Vancouver area.
And is it also twinning the Portman Bridge as well?
Yeah.
Twinning as in making double the lanes on the bridge.
One of the biggest things they're doing is twinning the Portman Bridge and Highway 1 from Vancouver to Langley. So that'll take it from 4 to 6 lanes, depending on the part, to 10 lanes, I believe, even all across. So quite a big leap, about double the theoretical capacity if you look at it like that. So, sort of back to the argument against why it's not going to work, is that people are going to see this bigger highway, which without much doubt will probably improve transit in the short period, and see that, oh, now I can live in Langley and get to downtown in 50 minutes rather than an hour and a half. That's a lot of extra time every week for people. That's quite a huge incentive. So people are going to be more likely to live in Langley rather than in Vancouver. And you're going to, in essence, induce traffic. So more people will live farther away. And it won't take too long before that. There's just more cars on the highway than before.
Are you sure that that's a correlation, that people are going to want to move further away because transportation to get there is easier?
I would echo that. I mean, I would assume that people want to move further away because of expenses.
Or they want to live farther away. Like, for instance, let's just say for the sake of argument that I had a teleporter that I could live in Victoria and work in Vancouver, and I could just beam myself back and forth. I still wouldn't do it because I don't want to live in Victoria. I don't have anything against Victoria for our Victoria listeners. I just don't want to live there.
And on this, too, isn't there a sort of an inversion that usually people live in one place for decades, mm-hmm. but their jobs, especially the more modern we are, I'll have 5 or 6 jobs, and, you know, who knows where my job, it might be downtown Vancouver, it might be in Port Coquitlam, it could be in Abbotsford.
Yeah, all those are valid points. I'm not saying that this is the only thing people take into consideration. Obviously, some people live in Langley because, as I have on here somewhere, say you have $500,000 to spend on a house. In Langley, that gets you a 6,000-square-foot house with a fairly large yard. In downtown Vancouver, that gets you about 1,200 square feet and no yard. So for especially for someone with a family, there's almost no question there. As long as the commute isn't so horrible, they're going to want to live in Langley.
Okay, so, and I do agree that's a good point, Daniel. Like, I mean, but the way I think about it, like, people don't move that often. Like, I'm thinking of, like, my own life, for instance. Mm-hmm. Maybe you guys can echo this as well. You're probably going to live with your parents till you're about 22, 23. I mean, most people are doing that about now.
Yep.
you're going to move out. And you're probably not going to be in that new area for a little while. Probably going to rent. Mm-hmm. You're probably not going to buy your own home until you're starting your family, which might be another 10 years down the road. So, I mean, you might have, like, maybe three big moves early in your life, followed by a final move when you retire.
Yeah.
Those could be separated by a good 25 years.
I think another thing, too, that's going on, what Ethan is saying, is that the dynamics of how people live is changing. I mean, when I was growing up a few decades ago, right, you're going to buy a house, you're going to settle down. Then the next generation or so, you buy a condo and settle down. Now I'm not sure if people even think they can afford a condo, except rarely, and everyone's going to be renting. And that also changes the whole dynamics as to, I mean, if you're going to buy a house, then roads are important because you have to build a house somewhere.
But I think what goes along with that change is a change in transportation, period. I don't see myself owning a car in my lifetime unless I absolutely have to because my kids have soccer across town. You know what I'm saying?
You have kids?
No. In 10 years, when I have children.
Chloe's definitely right. It's not just people moving. That's more of a long-term thing. It's also people switching from driving a car to transit or from transit to a car. If sort of this fairly rational theory bears out in evidence, once the twinned portman is done, you probably will see a decrease in SkyTrain ridership especially from Surrey and Langley, as more people will be likely to drive. So that's part of it. It's also partly, because people are just... so many housing developments are popping up in Surrey and Langley that there are, even if people who currently live there don't move a lot, there's a lot of people moving there.
So let's run with the assumption, because I think we've sussed this part of it out, that, okay, there are people who live in urban sprawl. We're going to introduce that word now, sprawl. Mm-hmm. And that roads is one way of trying to manage the transportation from urban outlier to urban inlier. Mm-hmm. So what evidence do you have that shows that roads are good or bad at that?
Yeah, there's a decent amount of evidence out there. One I looked at, which is sort of a review of most of the rest of the evidence, which is generally the best thing to do rather than looking at individual studies, found that, and this is some economic parlance I will explain in a second, but just hold on to it for now, is that in the short term, the elasticity of traffic volume is -0.4, and in the long term, it is -1.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah. So what does that mean? Basically, what that means is for -0.4, if you have, say, a 100% increase in capacity, so you're doubling the size of the road.
I'm going to stop you briefly. You might want to talk about elasticity before you talk about the values. Like, I'm not sure our viewers understand elasticity in terms of economics.
I'm using the values to better explain it.
Okay,
so
sorry.
In the short term, say you increased a highway capacity by 100%, so you doubled it. The -0.4 elasticity, what that is saying is that you will get a 40% increase in number of cars using that road within about a year. So that's quite a lot if you think about it. Basically what that's saying is that, say you have 100,000 cars crossing the Portman Bridge every day, you double the capacity so it can support up to 200,000, and within about a year you're going to have 140,000 cars passing per day.
So to use your analogy in the word elasticity, let's pretend I had a graph with an elastic band.
Yeah.
And I put my finger on it and I pushed it down -4.
Yeah.
That means there'd be 40% more traffic in the future with this.
Yeah.
And then later on, you're saying about, what is it, 20 years later on? If I push the elasticity of the capacity to 1, so we have 200% traffic. So we have the original 100%, and it doubles, essentially it doubles.
Mm-hmm. So basically what all these studies have found is that within about 10 years, the majority or the average road is going, or the average highway expansion is going to use up all of its extra capacity.
This actually goes on with something called the Brass's paradox, that the more roads you build, the more congestion you tend to get.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why don't we take a break from the elastic roads, and we'll take a commercial break here, come back, and Daniel will explain more about transportation and skepticism.
Life is hard. The world is cold. You're always too young, and then too old. But we've changed all that. Escape from life at the new Waves on How concert series, where you're never too young or too old to rock out with Vancouver's most amazing bands each Friday and Saturday night from 8 p.m. till midnight. Sponsored by Covenant House. Come enjoy the show and donate to Covenant House's Street Youth Services Program. Join the Waves on How Facebook group for all the info. Waves on How is not responsible for smiling, laughing, singing, dancing, or sudden outbursts of complete happiness that may be caused by the Waves on How concert series.
One life begins. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops.
So we were talking about urban sprawl and how roads don't seem to be the answer, that if you build more roads, you're just going to get more traffic.
Yes.
Or am I paraphrasing like that incorrectly?
Like that great baseball movie, if you build it, they will come.
In fact, I heard in, Seoul, Seoul, Korea, they had a 5-mile-long highway, like 10-lane highway right in the center of the city, and they bulldozed it down, and they put it in a big park, and everyone was freaking out because they figured, oh my, it's going to be so bad. Mm-hmm. But apparently traffic congestion actually went down, and it was quite improved.
Yeah, it's like the same thing that happened in Vancouver when they took away 2 lanes from the Bard Street Bridge and gave them to bikes. Everyone thought that the usually congested Bard Street Bridge is going to become incredibly horrible now, and in reality there was really no difference for anyone driving. No one really noticed a huge difference. But anyways, back onto suburban sprawl. Actually, I generally like to say suburban sprawl. Generally people say urban sprawl. Let's just say they're equal.
We'll agree to disagree on that one.
It doesn't really matter. So basically what I would argue, and what many other academics and different groups argue, is that the key problem with transportation is just that people live too far away from places they constantly go to. Now, you can make better ways to transport them from place A to place B, and that's going to help, but ultimately, people just need to stop living so far from where they work, so far from where they go to school. Now, to go back into sort of economic reasoning here a little bit, the reason people live so far away from where they work, the major area, or the major place people work in the sort of greater Vancouver area, is downtown Vancouver. Not nearly as many people live there as work there. So there's obviously going to be people who live far away from where they work. And the reason they do that is because living in downtown Vancouver is very expensive compared to suburban areas. So Surrey, Langley is a lot cheaper to live in than downtown Vancouver. So why is it so much more expensive? Well, that gets a little difficult. And
it's a place to be.
Yeah, it's partly just because naturally some people do want to live close to where they work. They realize a benefit of that. They like downtown Vancouver. They like how close they can be to everything, how you can live like 10 minutes from Stanley Park.
There's also actually an irony, and this is coming up, I learned this from my recent Vancouver research, that the property taxes, right, there's an active shift to take property taxes away from businesses and put them onto residential. Right now it's about 50-50, and they want to make it more like 75-25, mm-hmm. which ironically means if you live downtown where there's lots of businesses, there's actually less tax revenue. So the increased density means it's one way to get it back, whereas in Langley where they've got no industry at all. No?
Well, I wouldn't say no industry, but not as much.
They have some farms. You know.
If you talk, though, about the urban centers around Vancouver, mm-hmm. I mean, Surrey, as far as I know, is like the fastest growing city in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. As Surrey grows and becomes identifiable as Surrey and not, you know, that place next to Vancouver,
yeah.
it's going to develop its own attraction. People are going to want to say, no, no, I want to live in Surrey because it has the Surrey downtown.
That is true, and Surrey is doing some decent things to promote that. With their Surrey city area, they're working towards greater density so that people aren't super, super far away from where they need to go all the time, which is sort of the key thing I'm getting at here.
Right. So essentially, we do. We get population densities, mm-hmm. and then we get people who don't want to live in the dense area for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But the jobs still tend to be focused in the denser areas.
Yeah.
So how do we get the people from point A to point B? We've already kind of ruled out roads because we say, well, roads work in the short term, kind of, but ultimately they tend to be self-defeating. What other option is there?
West Coast Express.
Horses? Is it horses?
Yeah, no. Oh. Well, you totally skipped the part that you didn't like of mine. Convenient. I'll just quickly,
I'm sure you'll blog about that.
I'll just quickly go over it. Part of the reason I think that there's so much sprawl, and some academics and other groups agree with me, although not everyone does, is that sprawl is heavily subsidized. And the word subsidized here is maybe not the best, but it's promoted by government. They pay for things that either the developers building farther and farther out then don't have to pay for, or it's services that are paid for by the general pool. So say everyone in Surrey or everyone in BC is paying for roads that largely help expand to new areas. So they aren't paying for the brunt of the cost of making their new homes.
I think the biggest problem I had with the word subsidy in that is that there's a sort of implication that people won't need schools even if they move to downtown, and people mm-hmm. won't need water even if they move downtown. I mean, these are basic things. Even the roads, okay, because mm-hmm. we've kind of talked, there's still going to be some sort of transportation to get people from point A to point B, mm-hmm. even if it is in a more denser area. Mm-hmm. So that's why the word subsidy is not a word I would use, but this is your topic, so yeah. We'll use the word subsidy for right now.
Yeah, I understand that's not the best, but I'll quickly go through some of these, and then we'll move on to solutions because we're running out of time. So basically, some of the ways that the government, different levels of government promote expansion of urban sprawl is building new roads. So these are the smaller roads connecting to outer areas, as well as highways. Highways are probably one of the biggest ones. Expanding public transit. I don't think this is a huge cause of it, but certainly it doesn't. If you expand transit out to Surrey, it certainly doesn't make people less likely to live farther out in Surrey. It makes them more likely to live farther out in Surrey, but small compared to roads. Schools, sewer, water, power, policing, and then even direct subsidies. So government stepping in and saying, oh, you make this housing subdivision and we'll pay for some stuff directly.
Irrespective of part of that. Let's go with the public transportation, because I think that's one area where we kind of agree. So even if it does sort of promote people to live in Langley, the fact that you actually have public transportation there, people tend to congregate around those. So even if it is diverse in one sense, it does tend to be clumped in the other sense.
That's true. If you look at Surrey, the developments that go up around the SkyTrain station in Surrey is very dense developments. It's not large 6,000 square feet houses spread over huge areas.
So what's the cost comparison then from expanding TransLink to Portman project?
Well, it sort of depends on what public transit you go for, but I'll compare, say, the Canada Line to twinning the Portman. Twinning the Portman will cost $3.1 billion, assuming it gets in on budget, although it does look like it's going to. That doesn't include the cost of twinning the rest of the highway, which is going to be well over $1 billion for that. But that's sort of the major chunk of it. In comparison, the cost of the Canada Line was about $2 billion. And the Canada Line already has about 100,000 people use it per day. However, its capacity could be a lot higher than that, and it likely will go up. Whereas the Portman Bridge, or okay, the busiest part of Highway 1, that's the only figure I could find, has 140,000 vehicles pass per day. So assuming you double that, the sort of doubling of the Portman is giving you 140,000 extra vehicles per day. So, I mean, it's really hard to compare them. It's apples and oranges to some extent, but clearly the Portman Bridge it's not a very cheap way of doing it, nor really is the Canada Line.
And I also notice, just so that we can finish before the end of the show, that the idea that the highways have is that drivers essentially get to choose their own routes, whereas mm-hmm. public transportation kind of follow a fixed route. Mm-hmm. And I was noticing in my research that there's this study called The Price of Anarchy in Transportation Networks. And you like this, it uses a lot of your kind of terms there. It says, selfish drivers typically waste 30% more time than they would under socially optimal conditions, that the Nash equilibrium, which you'll tell us what it is in a minute, mm-hmm. is less efficient than an equilibrium reached by drivers who act unselfishly, that is, when they coordinate their movements by public transportation. So the idea, if everyone takes that, you're not being selfish because you're doing it as a group, but in some instances, in this particular instance, it actually leads to a more efficient outcome overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for people who don't know, that a Nash equilibrium is basically if multiple people are given a few different choices for things they can do, a Nash equilibrium is the point that they all end up at if they focus purely on their own self-interest. So sometimes that, maybe even a lot of the time, that is not the socially optimal position. In this case, it seems to be that way. So yeah, we're running out of time very quickly, so I'll just briefly sum up the rest of this. Basically, public transit is a more efficient way of moving large numbers of people. Obviously, you could make arguments that cars are more comfortable, or people like being alone in their giant spacious Hummer. And I'm not going to tell you you're wrong, but without a doubt, public transportation is more efficient. It takes up less space. It doesn't sort of cut cities in half.
In my research, I discovered a site that was against sort of urban sprawl and for urban density. And they actually mentioned a great hybrid that's happening here is you have your public transportation for most of your needs, but then you get like a co-op car or a co-op truck. So for those times when you actually do need a truck, because, I mean, transit isn't perfect all the time. Sometimes you need to haul something.
Try moving on transit. I don't think it's going to work.
So that it allows, you know, people to have access to a vehicle when they need it, but it reduces the actual density of cars, but still providing the convenience of cars. I thought that was a great, great thing.
Yeah, and I noticed that we're out of time, so I will put up the rest of my argument online, and I will actually do it this week.
Yes, Daniel, very prolific blogger. Let's move on to our skeptical highlights to wrap things up. I have a good one. On Wednesday, October 27th, CFI, the BC Humanists, and the SFU Skeptics present Marcy McDonald, who is the author of The Armageddon Factor, which is the story of the Christian right in Canada. That's at 8 p.m. at SFU Harbour Centre, room 1900. So check that out.
I think you got that wrong. I think you meant the Christian wrong in Canada.
Oh,
no.
Wrong.
Let's see. On October 28th at 7:30, we have Skeptics in the Pub Richmond, which is at Legends Pub, which is not even 5 minutes walk from the Breakhouse SkyTrain station. As always, it's a great time, so come out and bring your friends.
I have more of a skeptic warning. People who listened to our show about a year ago, maybe a little less than a year ago, I did a thing about the conspiracy theory with Jesse Ventura. It's a series that's supposed to debunk or confirm conspiracy theories. And it was a horrible, horrible show. Season 2's come out. I watched the first show, and they took as valid evidence a photoshopped picture. They didn't do any investigation. It was just like, oh, look, here's a picture of something that looks spooky. Oh, it must be true. It's on the internet. And it's just a horrible, 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 horrible show.
So, yeah, don't watch that. And along the lines of things related to topics we did about a year ago, I talked about education reform, and now there's a great documentary about it called Waiting for Superman. It's been getting pretty rave reviews, as well as lots of people who, like academics in that field, say it at least probes interesting questions. The UBC Freethinkers will be going to see that this Thursday. The at 6:30 at Festival Cinemas, Vancouver, Fifth Avenue. And, yeah.
And Chloe's skeptic highlight for this week is to think.
Yes, always think. Thanks, Don.
A good title for yourself for the show.
A good title for myself for the show.
Yes, very good. Okay, well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
This is the talented Don, saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Chloe, looking for a title.
And this is Daniel, still waiting for Superman.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Brittany!